Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey everyone, how are we all doing today? Welcome back to another episode of Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. My name's Al Horner, and joining me this week is one of the biggest names in American comedy of the last few decades. He's a filmmaker synonymous with a mid-noughties era of movies about incapable men. Men forced to grapple with the realization that maybe, just maybe, it's about time they grew up. He's the writer-director of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, the co-writer of Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story and Fun with Dick and Jane, Anchorman, Superbad, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and Step Brothers are just a few of the beloved comedies that he's worked on as a producer, and I haven't even mentioned yet the remarkable run of comedy dramas that he's been writing and directing for the last decade or so. Films like This Is 40, Funny People, and The King of Staten Island. Yes, on this week's episode, Judd Apatow is here, and he's revisiting one of his best-loved movies, 2007's hilarious Knocked Up. Now, if you've listened to the show before, you'll know that typically each episode, our guest breaks down their first draft of what became a beloved movie. Today, though, we're going a slightly different direction. It's not a first draft screenplay that we're digging into with Judd. Instead, as a window into his creative process, we're looking back at emails that the filmmaker sent to himself in the run-up to writing this movie. These emails contain all sorts of scattershot ideas about what Knocked Up could be, and provide great insight into how Judd's comic mind works. The film, as I'm sure you all remember, followed a stoner played by Seth Rogen, who has a drunken one-night stand with a high-flying media personality played by Katherine Heigl. What happens next? Well, the clue's in the title. In the spoiler conversation that you're about to hear, Judd and I discuss how his own adventures in parenthood with his partner Leslie Mann helped inspire its plot. We talk about how the movie broke American taboos around pregnancy, and also look at where next for Judd after three decades of celebrated storytelling. A huge thanks to Judd for being a great guest, and a massive thank you as ever to our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible. If you like what we do and want to help the show continue to grow, head to patreon.com/scriptapart, where you can subscribe for the price of a single monthly cup of coffee. Ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, the chance to submit your questions to upcoming guests. These are just some of the perks that you get if you join that community. So what are you waiting for? Get involved today. That address again, in case you're interested, it's patreon.com/scriptapart. Okay, That's enough of my rambling. Let's hand things over to our brilliant guest. This is the fantastic Judd Apatow discussing the first draft secrets of Knocked Up. Thanks so much for tuning in, everyone. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demeck. Judd Apatow, great to have you with us. How's it going today?
Happy to be here.
Glad to hear it. Well, thank you so much for coming on Script Apart, which from what I understand, isn't all too dissimilar to something that you did when you were coming up. Like the way that this show for me is, cards on the table, a thinly veiled way of getting tips from writers I admire that then hopefully benefits my work as a screenwriter. You began your career conducting radio interviews where you would talk to comedians as a means of figuring out your craft, right? Like when I came across that detail in my research, I felt kind of seen, as the kids say.
Yes. Your nerddom connected with my nerddom.
Is there a sense of full circle when you sit down for interviews like this, dishing out advice on your craft, the way that Seinfeld, Jay Leno, those guys did, the way that those guys helped you find a path when you were a kid?
What I usually think is, man, was I a terrible interviewer. Because I was, 15, 16 years old. So most of my interviews were like, so how do you get stage time? How do you get a job as a comedian? I mean, they're really rough to re-listen to. But yeah, sometimes I think about it, but I really think I didn't do that good a job. It was pretty interviewing 101. Because, when I was a kid, there weren't a lot of places to hear comedians speak at length or comedy people to speak at length. So you might see someone on the Tonight Show. You might see them on the local news for 5 minutes, but there was no place to see someone talk for an hour. So on some level, I think I was trying to invent the podcast. I just wanted to go in depth with people. And the reason why a lot of people said yes, and this is in the early 80s, is because no one wanted to talk to them. No one really talked to, these people like Harold Ramis, for an extended period of time, maybe for a newspaper article or a magazine article here and there. But they weren't busy the way a celebrity or a filmmaker is now, where they're drowning in interviews. They're always talking for massive lengths of time. I think they said yes because their publicists were trying to get them something so they would look like they were doing a good job for them. And they would set them up with some high school kid. And then they'd be annoyed when they realized, oh, this isn't a real interview. This is like for some high school where the signal doesn't really get out of the parking lot.
Are there particular lessons from those conversations, though, that you can tangibly feel yourself carrying forward even today?
I think the biggest and most important part of it was it made people real. So you see a movie. Say you see Ghostbusters, and the people in it, as a teenager for me, they're gods. They don't exist with normal people. So to sit with Harold Ramis and have him talk about working on a movie and, what the process was, made me feel like, oh, a human being did this. I'm a human being. Maybe I'm capable of being in the same world as them. I think that was the most important thing. I just thought, oh, I'm not that different than most of these people. They're just going for it. And they also worked really hard for an enormous amount of time to learn their craft. And if I'm willing to work that hard and take risks, maybe there's a possibility that I could do this. And then there were specific lessons, I think most of them having to do with patience, because learning how to do things takes a long time. This was when no one talked about 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
So the whole Malcolm Gladwell idea that you put in 10,000 hours to get good at what you're trying to learn how to do, that wasn't in the culture. I learned that from talking to comedians who said, oh, it takes 7 years to find your voice, or from talking to Harold Ramis about how he used to write jokes for Playboy magazine, and then he wrote jokes for Rodney Dangerfield, and learning all the steps and realizing, oh, it's a process to get great at this. And I need to be patient, and I need to be willing to learn. Even now, I was just taking a class on flow, about how to get into states of flow where you're at your most creative. I'm always trying to figure out how to be better at what I'm doing. And the only way you can do that is if you're not cocky and you think there's a long way to go. And I learned that from talking to all of those people.
Well, that work talking to all those comedians as a means of finding your voice, I think it's fair to say paid dividends. Like it's such a well-established voice, such a well-known comic signature that you have, to the point where in the mid-noughties, we had the emergence of this phrase, the Apatow comedy, which became almost a genre unto itself. Like it was this umbrella term that promised a certain type of comedy with a certain type of protagonist, a certain type of dialogue, a certain type of narrative groundedness, and even a particular length. Like there was a runtime to these comedies that was part of what you were known for. We're talking about Knocked Up today, which I think is the film that really familiarized audiences with a lot of those calling cards. How do you reflect back now on that whole period and what it was like to find yourself and collaborators like Seth suddenly at the center of the American movie-going zeitgeist after years of grind? Like, was it as much of a whirlwind as I imagine?
You know, for me, it came out of a lot of things not being successful for a long time and working on projects which I loved, some of them which became cult hits, and then suddenly finding our audience. So we worked on the Ben Stiller Show, which was a sketch show in the United States, which only lasted 13 episodes, but we won an Emmy for it. So we thought maybe we're going in the right direction. I got to work for Gary Shandling at the Larry Sanders Show and direct an episode. And then I worked on Heavyweights with my friend Steve Brill, who wrote it with me and directed. And that was the first movie we got made, which was our attempt at a Disney movie, although it came out much more demented than a normal Disney movie. And then me and Ben Stiller worked on The Cable Guy, which Ben directed, and I did rewrites on and produced. And that did like okay, but I think the expectation was really high that it was going to be gigantic. And it was a bit of a controversial movie because it was Jim telling people, I'm not going to do what you expect me to do. I'm not going to do the same types of characters as I did in The Mask and Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber. I'm going to also try weirder things and darker things. And it was an important moment in his career because he was training his audience to go, get ready, this is going to be a ride that's a little more challenging. But people couldn't quite handle it when it first came out. It's since had a great afterlife. But I think at the time, for people, they thought it was darker than we ever considered that it was. But again, something that was considered not the hit it was supposed to be. And then we did Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared, and both lasted one season. And we loved both of those TV series, but neither of them were a big hit. So there was a lot of bumps in our careers. We love the work, but we were like, how come people aren't really going for this in the way we wished that they would? And what changed it, I think, was when Will Ferrell did Old School and Elf, he broke through in a big way. And I had been, producing on Anchorman. Adam McKay and Will wrote it, and Adam was going to direct it, but we couldn't get anyone to make it. And I think that Will's success suddenly opened up the door for us to do things. And then suddenly all these scripts that we had been working on for years were being considered again. Superbad and Pineapple Express. And then suddenly we were allowed to make Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And then they just said, all right, well, we'll do most of those things that you're trying to do. But the key was that in our failure, we were all writing a lot and we were all helping each other because we were all on some level struggling to get where we wanted to go. So we would do table reads and everyone was there. All the Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared people and Chandling would show up and McKay would show up and we would all try to help each other. And I think that one of the reasons why the quality is high is because there really was a community there.
You mentioned the Freaks and Geeks crowd there. You obviously worked on that show with past Script Apart guest Paul Feig. When we talk about your brand of comedy and the fact that there's a certain emotionality in there, Judd, and a certain degree of autobiography in there too, Was Freaks and Geeks where you started to incorporate that into your work? Like, you've described The 40-Year-Old Virgin as a silly story that stemmed from your insecurities in the dating world. Knocked Up, as we'll get into, was part inspired by you and Leslie taking the plunge into parenthood. On Freaks and Geeks, it sounds like, you know, that was the beginning of all that. You know, you were given the opportunity on that show to thread in some of your own experiences growing up in a household where there were these two warring parents on a path to divorce. Was that show the seed of all this, where that strand of your work began to blossom?
I think when I worked for Gary Shandling, you know, his whole approach to the work was to dig deep and to reveal yourself and try to find the core of all the characters, get to this emotional truth. He studied with this acting coach named Roy London, and Roy London's whole thing was to use yourself in your art. If you're in a bad mood that day, we'll somehow bring it into the work. And I would see how Gary would have these funny moments in his life, and then he would put it on the show. And some of those were the best moments in the series. He would get into a fight with someone in real life, and then he would bring them on the show to recreate a fight he just had in real life with that person. You know, he used to date Sharon Stone. And so then on the show, Larry Sanders has an episode with Sharon Stone, who he used to date. And he was the person that taught me what the work was really about. It's about exploring people and their motivations and their humanity. And he always said the show is about people who love each other, but show business gets in the way. But really what he meant was ego gets in the way. You know, our need to be loved or accepted gets in the way of us being real and connecting with others. And he loved the idea of talking about masks. The way we try to present ourselves to others is often false. Oh, I want you to think I'm confident, but I'm falling apart inside. And that's what makes the show funny, is watching Hank Kingsley ask for a raise and try to act tough like he deserves it, but you know he's so hurt that you're not giving it to him fast enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when we did Freaks and Geeks, once the show started going and we were expanding on all the characters that Paul Feig had created, we all talked about what our childhoods were like and tried to find a way to inject that into the storylines of all the characters and the supporting characters. My parents had an ugly divorce, so I had a lot to say there. And some of it was said through Bill's issues with his mom dating his gym teacher. And some of it was put into Sam Levine's character, Neil, getting obsessively into ventriloquism when he knew that his father was cheating on his mom. And Sachs and Judah, Gabe Sachs and Jeff Judah, had a story from Jeff's childhood about trying to figure out who your dad was cheating with because you found a garage door clicker that wasn't to your house, and driving around town trying to figure it out. And so everyone really gave of themselves, and it clearly was working. And I was able to make that connection. Oh, the more personal I get, the more people are connecting with the material. And I used to think that my life was boring, and I really had a hard time trying to figure out what was interesting about me. And I think in the success of some of the ideas that I was able to write, I thought, oh, maybe my life is just as interesting as everyone else. Maybe everyone's life is interesting equally.
If I can just go back to something you said there about your parents' divorce and how acrimonious it was. At that point, were you already invested in comedy? Did that episode lead to you embracing comedy as like a release valve for some of the anxiety of being caught up in that situation? Or were you always on a pathway, do you think, to loving comedy and wanting to pursue it as a career?
My family valued comedy. My grandfather had a record company and worked in the record industry. My dad worked for his record company. And my dad loved Bill Cosby and Woody Allen and George Carlin. We had Lenny Bruce records at the house. And they loved comedy. They loved Peter Sellers and Mel Brooks and Blake Edwards. So on some level, it was considered an honorable profession in my home. And my grandma was friends with this comedian named Toadie Fields, who was a big comedian in the 60s and the 70s. So people in my family talked about her like she was very special. And before my parents got divorced, I loved comedy. I was obsessed with the Marx Brothers primarily. And I would watch all the comedians on all of the talk shows. It probably kicked up a notch when my parents got divorced, because I did have this feeling, oh, I need to get a job. Like the world is unstable. I need to be on my shit. And it made me want to study it and understand it. And also, no one in high school and at any level of school had interest in comedy. And I think there was a part of me that thought, wow, no one in this entire school cares about this, but I know it's a real job. So maybe it's the job I can get because I'm not competing with these people. I mean, there's probably only a couple hundred people in the whole country whose job is comedy. I guess I could be one of 200 people because it didn't feel like anyone wanted to even do it. So when I got to California, I met those 200 people and they became great friends, but it still felt like there's not so many people trying to do this that I have no shot. I would assume now it feels a little scarier in a way. But back then, there were maybe 50 comedy clubs in the whole country. And, you know, there was comedy on television and some comedy movies, but there was room for more.
One thing that was coming up a lot in these early films of yours, Judd, was a tendency towards this kind of man-child protagonist, this guy who really struggles to embrace adulthood. So Seth's character in Knocked Up, Ben Stone, when we meet him, he and his friends are just trapped in this perpetual state of adolescence. And, you know, a lot of the comedy comes from that kind of ridiculous inability to grow up. That was quite commonplace in the comedy of this era. Like, so many of Will Ferrell's characters during this time were also ticking that box. And, well, there was literally a show called Arrested Development on TV at the time. It was a big running theme of that whole era in American pop culture, and I think it's something we've moved away from a bit since. Can I get your read, as someone who wrote a great many characters in this mold, like Ben Stone, on where that came from? Like, was it as simple as there's great comedy to be mined in watching a man-child have to finally grow up? Was there something dramatically interesting about it? I'm obviously aware that, you know, some people have drawn the link between this type of comedy, that type of character, and the fact that, you know, the president in the White House during that era was a man who was remarked upon often as having man-child-esque mannerisms, George W. Bush. Do you have a hot take on why, as a culture, during that time, that was a character type who filmmakers were gravitating towards and who audiences in turn were lapping up?
I think in the history of comedy, it's been that most of the time, because most comedic characters need to learn lessons. If they don't, there's no story there. So if you look at it in the history of it, Abbott and Costello are, you know, man-children, the Marx Brothers, the Three Stooges, Jerry Lewis. It's just something that works well in comedy because someone who has their act together and is mature is not funny. It's a person who's a mess, who has a lot of flaws, who has some beatings to take before they get something. And I also think that everyone is immature. I'm 55 years old. I don't feel that much more mature than I did 20 years ago. And I'm friends with people who are much older. I have friends in their 80s and their 90s. I interviewed Mel Brooks a few weeks ago for The Atlantic. He doesn't seem that mature. And he's about to turn 97. So I don't know. Isn't everybody a man-child for most of the ride? You know, how many of us really get mature? So it felt organic to us. I do remember that Paul Feig always said when we were working on Freaks and Geeks that there were some kids that desperately wanted to grow up and there were some kids who desperately wanted to stay children. And that's what the show was about. Lindsay wanted to grow up and Sam wanted to stay a child. And there's something funny about not wanting to grow up. It's funny to be in over your head and to not know how to be in a relationship and not know how to make a living or raise a child. It's, you know, that's the essence of comedy that we all connect with the fact that it's so hard and we're all so lost.
You once said of funny people that it's often not till years after you've made a movie that you understand what it is you were writing about, the kind of part of yourself you were trying to express with that project, Judd. To zero in on Knocked Up, and it really was difficult picking one particular movie to focus in on in our time with you today, Judd, just because I honestly picked Knocked Up solely for the very, very thin reason that there was a DVD director's commentary that I used to listen to all the time of Bill Hader dropping goofy impressions every 5 seconds in it. Is Knocked Up one of those movies to you, Judd, where, yeah, it did take a little while after the project for it to become crystallized what it was you were trying to explore or express? Or, you know, is that one of those where you were kind of quite clear about what the emotional resonance was when you were writing it?
I think that's one where I knew what I was trying to do, which was to show people in the middle of dealing with an unexpected pregnancy, and then to have Paul and Leslie be those people in the future. So they, you know, it's like the ghost of Christmas future. Well, here's what's hard about it down the line. And I could talk about basically the same relationship in two different eras.
Yeah.
And I think that it was a great way to explore issues that came up for me and Leslie about, you know, not knowing what to do. I mean, you know, we've been very open about what is real. I mean, you know, when you do these things, usually it's like a third is from real life, a third is completely fabricated, and a third is stories from your friends. And it's just a soup. So it's not true, but it has a lot of truth in it. And there's something scary about suddenly having to have a baby and to want to do a good job. And what would be even scarier is if you didn't actually know the person you were about to have a baby with.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, was a metaphor for the terror of that responsibility and the idea that your childhood is over and your young, goofy days prior to responsibility are over. So he has all these friends that are in that moment of just goofing off and being idiots. And suddenly he's not allowed to do it anymore. He has to figure out what the next phase will be. And he's out of sync with his friends. And that's how I felt, because I was the first person of all my friends to have a kid. And suddenly you can't go hang out and just go to the mall and see movies and eat at night and hang out at comedy clubs, because there's a child at home, and it probably affects how they're going to feel for the rest of their lives if you leave or don't do a good job as a parent. I was aware of that, but there's always like details later on, you know, that sneak in through the process that you realize, oh, I must have been thinking about that, because that, you know, comes up there.
It sounds like the comedy and the drama, they kind of arrive at the same time for you. Knocked Up is like that's a very comedic premise. Like, it's an odd couple thing where you have two polar opposites who, one's a man child, as discussed, the other is this kind of high-flying career professional. They're brought together by a pregnancy. That is a situation that's ripe with comedic potential. I had wondered whether there was like a process you had to go through to then kind of find your emotional access point, the parts of your own life that you can kind of mine for the emotional depth of it. But it sounds like the two always arrive, or certainly from what you were saying there, the two arrive kind of entwined. Is that correct?
One of the inspirations of it was that Seth and his wife, Lauren, when they went on their first date, they had a bad date. And then
they got into a car crash.
And I guess it wasn't a little fender bender. It was a real car crash of some type. Mm. And they felt like, well, that date did not go well at all. But as a result of this car crash, we should at least try it again. That was one of the ideas we talked about, you know, feeling forced into figuring something out, you know, giving something a try, even past the point where you think you should or need to. The responsibility, you know, you're going to have a baby, so I might as well find out if this guy could be a good father or a boyfriend, because we're connected for life anyway. So should I give him a couple of shots to figure out who he is? You know, that was the original inspiration. And how it happened was Seth was pitching me a lot of movies which had bigger premises or sci-fi, all the things that he's done brilliantly, you know, in the last decade. He always wanted to do that type of stuff, but that wasn't necessarily my interest. I'm fascinated just by people talking in restaurants for the most part. You know, I don't have much of an imagination. But I was saying to him, Seth, I don't think you need to really do that right now because you're interesting in the most mundane, simple situations. Just you getting a person pregnant, I could watch a whole movie of how you would deal with that. That's how it began. It began as a counter to Seth wanting to be more imaginative and do bigger things, which also things which I thought we couldn't get people to give us the money to do. On some level, I think maybe Seth understood the future of show business, where it was going, because that's what his generation wanted. And I was living in, you know, my world from when I was a kid, which is, you know, whatever, like the movie 10 or, you know, Diner. That those were the movies that fascinated me as a kid.
Let me read a tiny bit of an email, Judd, dated August 7th, 2005, 12:57 p.m. It reads, from Judd Apatow to Judd Apatow, subject pregnancy. I should state, actually, you know, for our listeners, before I go on, I have not hacked Judd's inbox. This is an email that's included in the Newmarket Shoot Script Series book for Knocked Up, which is a great read. The email reads, a couple gets pregnant on the first date. Older sister of the woman has kids and represents its difficulties and complications. Going through this helps her adjust her life in a positive way. She doesn't like Seth. Maybe Seth admits that she's right at some point. It goes on like this, this splurge of ideas for what Knocked Up could be and would wind up being. Like, a lot of it's here already in this initial email. Can you tell me about what you remember about this email that you sent on August 7th? Like, was that quite soon after Seth's car crash and your conversation with him about that? Or was there a bit of a gestation period before, you know, you started to kind of really form what Knocked Up could be and, yeah, started to get this all down on paper, so to speak, in email form?
Usually after there's an idea, I wonder if it's worth pursuing for a while. And then at some point I start making notes, which are like that email. And then if those notes are going well, at some point I commit that that's the movie I'm going to try to write. I wrote that email when I was on vacation. I was in Hawaii. And yeah, there were a few emails that had most of the movie in it. And I've generally found that that's how most of my movies have worked. There'll be an initial inspiration and, you know, 60% of it survives. I'll just see a little bit of an arc of a movie. And what I try to do is not have a story, but just allow my unconscious to occasionally present visions for scenes, moments, dialogue, without really knowing the story. And for a few months, I'll just write emails like that. What if they go to the doctor and this? What if, you know, they all take mushrooms at Cirque du Soleil? What if, you know, and it's all, this could happen, that could happen. Hundreds of ideas. And then at some point, I switch gears to reading that, putting them on cards, and just shuffling them around to see if an actual story has revealed itself. It's funny because I just saw Phoebe Waller-Bridge in some Instagram video about screenwriting, because I follow all those on Instagram, you know, short clips of people explaining how they write. And she said that's how she works, where, you know, she'll put things on cards and then it's really about shuffling them to see what it does as you shuffle. And it's good if you know the end, which is what I think too. I like to at least have a first guess at the end. But if I don't commit to a story for a while and a strict beat sheet, a lot of stuff will bubble up. As soon as I commit to the story, the bubbling kind of stops. And then I'm just fixing what I decided on. And maybe one of my weaknesses as a writer is I'm not one to really throw out like a 30-page movement. Once I've decided this is the story, I tend to just fix it I don't ever go, but what if this didn't happen in America? What if it happened in Canada? I never do that. I never change a big section of it. I try to stay in touch with that initial idea that I got excited by and not let go of it. But I find that that's really works. And I just finished a screenplay before the strike where I did the same thing. And it felt really good. It was the first movie I'd written alone since This Is 40, because I've been co-writing with people just because I got bored of being alone. I just wanted to spend more time with human beings. And it was really fun to write alone again and do this process.
Hey there, this is Al. Just jumping in to tell you that support for this episode comes from our friends at Mubi, the only streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the world. When I say that Mubi is home to both work by iconic directors and emerging auteurs, I'm not kidding around. Case in point, this week here in the UK, I revisited Park Chan-wook's Old Boy for its 20th anniversary, no idea where the years have gone there, and I caught Shiva Baby by the prodigiously talented new writer-director Emma Seligman. If you haven't seen the latter, it's an excruciatingly tense comedy that verges on horror in its depiction of a 22-year-old who feels the walls are closing in on her at a family event. Family events are, let's face it, always tricky, but especially so when they're attended simultaneously by mourning relatives, your ex-girlfriend, and a man best described as your sugar daddy. The best of cinema's past, the best of cinema's future, that's what Mubi is all about, but don't take my word for it. Try it for yourself today for free with a 30-day trial on us. Head to mubi.com/scriptapart to make new cinematic discoveries and reacquaint yourself with old classics. That address again, it's mubi.com/scriptapart, or click the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Arc Studio Pro. If you're a screenwriter looking for an intuitive way to pen that next great screenplay idea of yours, Arc Studio understands how you think and what you need to get in the zone and produce your best work. It has fantastic storyboarding features, its interface is miraculously distraction-free, and if you're one of those who has a writing partner, you're going to love their stress-free real-time collaboration tools, which are kind of similar to Google Docs. The software is being used by beginners and professionals alike, such as the team behind the Netflix show Arcane, and David Wayne, the writer-director behind Wet Hot American Summer. Arc Studio offers a completely free version of the software, meaning that anyone, anywhere can download it today and get writing, no matter their experience level. Or, to unlock Arc Studio's full suite of amazing tools, you can get $30 off a pro subscription by heading to arcstudiopro.com/scriptapart. That address again, if you want to join the thousands of screenwriters who have already made the leap, it's arcstudiopro.com/scriptapart, or click the link in today's show notes. Okay, let's get back to the conversation. You can definitely feel watching Knocked Up, having read this initial email, that, yeah, you do tend to sort of stick close to the spirit of that initial idea. In this email, you write, "We can show them meet, the first encounter, how it leads to sex. Not using birth control can be a major point of contention for the whole film. Why didn't they use it? The idea of being forced into a relationship for life is the main conflict. A relationship in reverse. A baby, then they get to know one another. A friend can say, no matter what, you guys are stuck dealing with each other till you die." And that is essentially the film in a nutshell. I'd love to know, Judd, how you, once you had that idea, how you began to kind of craft these characters in opposition to one another, to kind of accentuate the odd couple nature of it, to accentuate the contrast between the two of them. We've obviously got that really fun beginning, like opening scene where we're kind of intercutting between Seth's life as Ben, riding roller coasters and goofing around, and Catherine's character, Allison, who seems to have her life more together. Once you have an idea, how do you build characters out of it to kind of maximize the comedy?
For Seth's character, you know, we knew that it would be fun if he was a bit of a nightmare. And I certainly had a lot of friends who were hotheads and delaying their their maturation. So there is that moment after college where you kind of think, these are my fun years. And they think they're in that. It's the beginning of the internet. So they have a site where you can figure out where the nude parts are in scenes. You know, they're just idiots looking for a way to have an easy life where they could be stoned and make a lot of money off of a dumb idea. And a lot of it is based on, you know, my work with Seth and knowing him really well and his ideas. You know, what makes Seth so lovable? What makes him seem like he might not be the right person to raise a baby with? Because you would assume he would be very irresponsible and he's a pothead. And then slowly you realize, oh, he is a good guy. He's just in a different phase. That's why Harold Ramis was so important, because we thought when you meet his dad, you love him so much and he's such a great, wise person and a warm person that you realize that's in Seth.
Yeah.
That he's a young Ramis. That's why there's that great line that Ramis came up with where he's talking about drugs and he's like, you know, as long as it comes from the earth, it's okay. So, you know, a lot of it is based on, you know, a fictional version of a comic creation of Seth's. And much of that happened in auditions, because we auditioned 80 people to play Katherine Heigl's part. And Seth would improvise with everyone. So he really discovered the character through putting it on its feet. And we were always doing revisions based on what we were learning about that character. The Katherine Heigl's character, you know, we realized what it was when Katherine Heigl did it. I mean, we wrote it, but as soon as she did it with Seth, they were hilarious. And none of the auditions were ever correct. Sometimes you make a movie and a lot of people could have played the part. But in this movie, no one was doing it really appropriately with Seth. And I think it's because Katherine is funny, but she's strong. And, you know, she's vulnerable, but she's trying to, you know, keep her shit together. And she has to deal with this guy. And there was something about her strength that allowed Seth to be funny in the way Seth was funny. And then her standing up to him became really funny. And then they had some almost classic screwball comedy dynamic between each other. None of it was funny before Katherine did it. And it just made us laugh. And we had a great time shooting all those scenes and improvising. In terms of the other characters, I had worked with Paul Rudd on Anchorman, and Leslie and Paul were really fun to watch because some of it is based on my relationship with Leslie. But when you put her with Paul, it completely mutates it to a different variation of a relationship, because it's how Leslie reacts to the way Paul is playing it. So it becomes different in a way that's really, really funny. But it is, you know, it is a dynamic that we're all familiar with, which is that Seth kind of turns into Rudd, you know, and he's a pain in the ass, and he's a little out of tune, and he's not present and insensitive. And I think that Leslie's so funny with Paul in trying to do that dance with him, trying to talk to him, you know, about what he's doing, which is not, you know, up to snuff in the parenting department and in the husband department. And Leslie's one of the few people who can be very real and really funny at the same time without losing any of the credibility of the character or the situation. And they were just a great comedy team together. And also some of it is a little heartbreaking too, in the ways that they've lost the thread with each other and how they find it again. You know, one of the aspects of the movie which I like is it seems like Leslie and Paul have broken up, and so have Seth and Katherine, and the guys go to Vegas and they take mushrooms and they both really miss you know, the ladies in their life, and they go home and Katherine won't take Seth back. But then Seth sees Leslie and Paul and they're back together like nothing ever happened, because that's marriage. Like, you have to work it out.
Yeah,
you know, you're not dating. You know, you've got kids to raise, you know, all these things have to be dealt with in a mature way and moved past.
You mentioned Seth's job there. So it's a website called Stars of the Flesh. I was going to look up whether starsoftheflesh.com is still a website that exists and then realized I don't need that affecting my algorithm or whatever. But it kind of teases at something that must happen in your process, because again, in your early notes for this, you're talking about Seth's character maybe designing menus for DVDs or something with computers.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, Stars of the Flesh is infinitely more funny than that. So it seems like there's a process in which you, as I say, really push the material to its limits to find the funniest version it can be. What does that look like? Do you do an initial pass and then kind of like scene by scene, detail by detail, look for the different kind of opportunities to really crank up the comedy? Or yeah, how does it work? Is there a set in stone process for you, Judd?
It's really more trying to find a reality level and a tone that feels like it would work. That's why I loved Say Anything, because it's a really funny Cameron Crowe movie.
Yeah.
But it's real also. And it has these amazing moments of comedy, but it feels like life. But yet some of them are a little broad, but broad in the way life is. And so something that I realized along the way was people are weird. Life is crazy. People are broad in life. There is a way to show life that is accurate and grounded, but also insane at the same time, because that's what it is. So you don't have to reach to get to the joke. It can be organic. It can come from story and character, because these movies don't work when you feel like the movie's trying to get to something to be funny, but it's not really part of the story or the characters.
Yeah.
So yes, there were websites. There was a Mr. Skin website that had basically all the nude scenes from movies. And so I think that, you know, we had thought of this before we heard about Mr. Skin. And then we were like, oh no, there's something like it. But yeah, maybe there'll be other ones like it. And then we put it in the movie that there's, that you don't realize that they're already in competition with somebody else. And so what I think is that's funny, but someone did do that. So you can do that. And for Catherine, she works at the E Channel, and everyone at E is in fantastic shape. And it would be a hard place to get pregnant at, because it goes against the look of all the hosts. And that's why, you know, we had, you know, those scenes. Then we see Catherine's bosses, Alan Tudyk and Kristen Wiig. And Kristen Wiig had just started at SNL. And we were like, this is the funniest woman ever. She had no lines in the script. Alan Tudyk had all the lines. And then we just said, you're going to chime in. And it was just a day of improvisation. And they were so funny together. Alan is so funny. And they just had magical chemistry. And it was just one of the great moments in comedy, watching them do all that. So when you watch that, it's all Wiig. It's not me writing almost any of that. But that seemed like a tough job to have, you know, when you're pregnant. But it is a real job. You know, that's a real situation that people get into. So that's how I look at it. With each friend, we try to define them as deeply as we can. We knew what was funny about Jay Baruchel and how he, you know, interacted with all of his friends, our friends. You know, Siegel, we went with this kind of sleazy character. You know, Jonah, who had just only done 40-Year-Old Virgin with us, was completely fresh and open, so we could do the full Jonah, because no one knew Jonah. And it was the first real opportunity for him to go for it. And Martin Starr, obviously, we had worked with for a long time on Freaks and Geeks. And he is, you know, legendarily funny. And then we had Charlene Yee as his girlfriend. And they were like a great, weird stoner couple. And so we just try to make everyone as multidimensional as possible. And if you put in that work, then they are real. They're not just comedy movie characters. They fully come alive. And then they can improvise and play with each other, because there is a depth to what everyone is doing.
You mentioning Martin Starr there just reminded me of that really funny running gag in the background of the movie where he's taking part in some sort of bet to grow his facial hair, looking like, and I quote, Richard Reed the shoe bomber in the process.
Yeah. And that was an Evan Goldberg idea, because we knew we needed things like that, that in the house, there's just funny, dumbass stuff happening. And he talked about that, Evan, how they would have competitions where two people would grow a beard and it would just be, you know, the winner was the person who didn't shave. You know, you lost if you shaved. And there were things like that that Evan contributed to the movie. And Seth and Evan were hilarious as, you know, producers on the movie too, just pitching jokes all day long and incredible jokes.
Elements like that, though, you know, they give the film, and specifically like the male friendships in the film, such authenticity and such relatability. Like the conversations that these characters have on screen echo the ones that, you know, a lot of us have in our own personal lives with our male friends. Is there a process for how you capture that? Like, were you the kind of guy at the time to always have a notebook with you on nights out, jotting down the things your friends would say and the rhythms of those conversations? Or, how does it work? How do you go about, like, finding that dialogue that really gives the viewers this sense that these guys do hang out, their friendship is real?
I do as much as I can, but the process is long and very collaborative, especially on that movie. So you write it, and then you bring everyone in a room and you read it, and then you go, okay, you know what I'm trying to do in this scene, now let's improvise it. And then you take notes on the improvs, and then you rewrite it with some of the improvs. And then on set, you do the same thing. Sometimes I'll say, okay, let's do the scripted version. Oh, here's 30 things you guys said when we were improvising in rehearsal. Let's see if we can sprinkle some of these in. Okay, let's just do one where just get from A to B, and I don't care if you even hit the script. And, you know, we had a good amount of time for that shoot, and so everyone was allowed to play, and there's a lot of rewriting on our feet. I really feel like when you have people that are really hilarious, who have all, by the way, turned into writers.
Yeah.
Jason Segel's wrote a bunch of movies, obviously Seth and Seth and Evan and Jonah and Jay, they're all very gifted as creative forces. So you want them to make that contribution to the movie. I mean, that's before they all did most of that work. So I was just encouraging them and saying, your jokes are as good as mine. And then we would play. And then, you know, a lot of my job as a director is to edit it in my head. Are we getting it? I mean, I want to have some flexibility in the editing room, but I'm also listening. Okay, do I have all the connective tissue to play with this later? Are the tones matching? Are the performances matching? And that's a tricky part when you do a lot of improv. How do you make it seamless when the movie is edited? There's nothing worse than when you see a movie and you're like, oh, these actors are all just jacking off. And you can just tell, like, it's an improv fest and it's not quite working, but they left a lot of it in. It should feel, you should forget about the process when you watch the movie.
And that must result in a lot of jokes being left on the cutting room floor, like great jokes that you love, but unfortunately just don't serve the scene, or there was a better gag for that particular moment. Can you talk to me about like the mindset that you and your collaborators need to be in order to kind of, let those jokes go sometimes, the ones that you adore, but unfortunately they're just not quite right for the scene.
The only way to do movies like this is to have all of the actors and actresses be willing to put a lot out there and trust that I'll make it make sense later. Because you know, sometimes you work with people and they're like, I don't want to say it because you might use it. But you can't have that on this type of set because I have no idea what I'm going to use. It's the opposite of a Coen Brothers movie. It's not a play. Everything is up for grabs. So I have to be in a space where I know what I need, but at the same time, I'm trying to create space for something magical and other to happen, but it still has to serve the characters and the story. So there's a lot of playing, but it usually has a very specific purpose. So if I'm trying to show these guys and what they talk about and what their life is about, them talking about how they love Munich because Jews get to kick ass, you know, it says a lot about the type of days they're having and what they're talking about. They're not talking about raising children. They're really passionate about Munich.
This may be like one of those rumors, but I swear I heard Steven Spielberg was a fan of the Munich joke.
Well, he did put Seth in the Fableman, so maybe that was a full circle moment from the Munich joke.
Yeah, I suppose Seth, he owes you on that. You mentioned earlier, Judd, that kind of like what if stage where you're ideating things that could happen within your premise. You've got your premise for the film, and then you undergo this process of cataloging the obstacles that could fall in your character's way. One of the what ifs in that email that you sent to yourself, throwing around thought starters for Knocked Up, is the idea that Seth and Catherine's characters could have to go and live with Seth's parents. There's also a mention in there of them exploring the idea of putting the baby up for adoption. A friend of Catherine's character, you also wrote, could be very pro-abortion, which was another element that you explored. Ultimately, I don't think it made the script. What were some of the other kind of what-if plot ideas that you remember kicking around for Knocked Up between this email and then the finished script? Like, and how do you navigate all those what-ifs, the ones that should stay and the ones that should go?
Well, I think when I start, I really want to think of, you know, everywhere it could go. That's the first stage of writing the script. And so I just started thinking about people's relation to these moments where you realize you're going to have a kid. And I think that's where you would go. Should I put the kid up for adoption if I feel like I'm too young and immature to handle this? Would I get an abortion? You know, would I have the baby? I mean, they have the baby because Leslie and I had the baby. And our story wasn't exactly like that. But, you know, we had a baby young and we went for it. And so sometimes people go, well, why didn't they have an abortion? I'm like, because then there's no movie. There's no movie if they have an abortion. I think everyone should have the right to have an abortion, of course. I'm a big supporter of a woman's right to choose, and what's happening in our country is terrible in that respect. But this wasn't that. This was about relationships, and it was more about people trying to get to know each other under a very challenging circumstance. So we did have other discussions about abortion. One scene where that's what the scene was about. There was a scene where Seth tries to bring it up, and they had just seen the ultrasound, and they were discussing it, and they were looking at it, and Seth hints that maybe that's an option, and she's like saying it's a baby, and he's like, no, it's just a digital dot. It's just a digital dot. And the scene was repetitive to other moments in the movie. The main one being the one where Jonah Hill and Jay Baruchel debate abortion. And that was always this idea. Let's show the two biggest idiots in the world debate abortion. You know, later, because we lost the other scene, people were like, oh, they don't even use the word abortion. They say shmishmortion. And that stuck out because we lost another scene. You know, we certainly wanted the audience to know that there are other options, and we didn't want to say it would be wrong to make that decision. But we did want to show a really funny, moronic approach at debating that as a way of not doing the heavy version where we don't have all the answers anyway. So that became, you know, a funny thing in some of the reviews where they're like, this is a very conservative movie because they kept the baby. And I just thought, well, I don't know if it's conservative. I just know, you know, some people do and some people make other choices.
Wow, that's so crazy to me to think of this film being interpreted in any way as a conservative film. Like, when I think back to the kind of pop culture that I grew up on and the versions of this story that I saw in the films and TV shows that I was kind of surrounded by growing up, anytime someone had, someone became pregnant from a one-night stand or a couple were having a baby out of wedlock, there was typically like a sense of shame and catastrophe attached to it. Now, of course, I suppose in real life, presumably Seth and Catherine's character's situation, this is something that must happen quite a lot. Like, I don't know statistically, but it must happen all the time. It seems quite purposeful the way that Knocked Up was leaning into that, was leaning into the truth of that, was leaning into the messiness of their situation and embracing it and finding the beauty in it. Was that purposeful? Like, was there something you were actively seeking to achieve with this film in terms of there being one narrative around parenthood and you wanting to show a different version of it, a more accurate version of it, perhaps? Talk me through it.
I don't think I think about it in that way. I just remember, you know, when we were at the hospital having our first child, we just had this terrible situation where our doctor left town. We saw him that morning and he didn't tell us he was leaving town. And we thought we were about to have the baby. And he said, "You're not." He went to a bar mitzvah in Northern California. And suddenly we were in labor and didn't have a doctor. And so a lot of the beats in the hospital are pretty close to bad interactions with the doctor. Everything with Ken Jeong is in the universe of things that happened to us. And I wrote it down when it happened because I thought, this is just so crazy that this could even happen. I never in a million years would have imagined that a doctor can lie to you and not show up. And I didn't know that they passed you off to someone else in the office if they don't want to come. You know, I just didn't know that. So that was a big seed for the movie because I thought, oh, well, I have an ending. And I know at the end that they're there for each other and that Seth's character rises to the occasion and Catherine's, you know, character finally connects with Seth when Seth shows his other qualities. And so I work backwards from that, but I never think, oh, this is new and this is fresh. I mean, I knew we were doing some things that I hadn't seen before because I'm always trying to do that if I can, but it really was more working backwards from a crazy story that happened to us.
Well, two things. Number one, I hope that doctor ended up seeing Knocked Up and realizing that was
sure,
him on screen.
I'm sure there's multiple doctors that I did not get along with that saw the movie.
The second thing, of course, is, well, you mentioned the ending there. Because there was so much of yourself and Leslie in this story, and of course, things worked out the way they worked out with you guys, did that mean there was never a version of this story where you entertained, you know, Seth rises to the occasion, but they go off to start a life together, but maybe not in a romantic capacity? Were there different kind of configurations of what their life would look like after the birth that you kind of entertained, or was it always the ending that we see in the film?
I think that at some point when you're in rehearsals, you know what the ending is. And that was based on Catherine and Seth's chemistry. They got along great. They were really funny together. They seem like a unique couple. And you want them to survive. You want them to be a couple at the end. I could see with a different actress and a different actor, you might go, yeah, it doesn't feel right. They wouldn't actually be together at the end. But with them, it just felt right. And I'm sure if it felt differently, I probably would have shot an option for a different ending. And certainly we thought about that at times. But I always thought that that was the magic of the movie, is this stranger who seems like a nightmare turns out to be someone that you would want to be the father.
And what can you remember, Judd, of the immediate aftermath of the movie coming out? Like, we touched upon at the beginning how the film did seem to cement this perception of you as being a central figure amongst this new exciting community of comic filmmakers. There was you, Seth, Ferrell, Adam McKay, Bill Hader, Jonah Hill. You mentioned that post Anchorman, it was all snowballing so quickly for you guys within that community, and that projects that had sat on a shelf for years were kind of being greenlit all of a sudden, left, right, and center, everything moving very fast. Were you able, amidst all that chaos, to enjoy the moment as Knocked Up roared past 200 million at the box office, as it became this smash, all from this idea informed by your own experience, your experience with Leslie?
I remember that when we did the 40-year-old Virgin, it came out when I was in prep producing Talladega Nights. So I wasn't even in California when it opened. I didn't get the moment to really feel its success, I flew back for the premiere and then went back to North Carolina. So I didn't really have that feeling of success. And also that's when my mom got sick. So it was one of those moments where something really wonderful is happening while something really terrible is happening. With this movie, I was out in LA. We had a really fantastic premiere. You know, one of my intentions with the movie was to try to introduce a lot of people that I believed in the movie. Some of them were on TV shows we had done. Some of them were new people, but I did want to say, I think all these people should be comedy stars. That's why they're in the movie. They're not just cast. They're people that I thought, oh, each one of these should be the lead of their own movie. So we had a lot of fun doing that together, but the idea that the world agreed was maybe the great moment of that time, where now we would get movies from all of those people or television series. And that was very special because I think on some level I had been trying to do that my whole career at different times, you know, with Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared and a lot of projects where I'm not just making the movie or the TV show. I'm saying, I think you should like these people. And I hope they'll go on to make a lot of stuff that we all like. Because as a fan of comedy first, when I see someone great, I'm excited to work with them. But I'm also excited to be there at the launch of what might be an amazing career. And so that's what's so gratifying. When you look at what everyone's done, it's ridiculous. And when the movie came out, it got great reviews. And I remember just lines down the block in a way that was just startling. And I was able to enjoy it and enjoy that everybody else was getting a nice career boost. And suddenly we were allowed to make all these other projects, which, you know, who knows if we would have been able to or not.
Do you still feel like the same guy who wrote Knocked Up, Judd? Like there's been this growth, of course, in your work over the years. So I'm curious, like when you think back on a film like this, what are the ways in which you feel like the same kind of storyteller? And what are the ways in which, you know, that guy is someone who maybe you've left behind a bit?
I think with every project, you just throw yourself into the abyss and pray what you're thinking about makes sense. It's a very strange process. You have a notion that something might be good. You maybe can see it a little bit in your head. And then you get a lot of collaborators and it evolves and grows. And it is a form of madness to throw yourself into your creativity so deeply for a year or two. And you have to really believe it's going to work or you can't do it, but you kind of don't know if it's going to make any sense or work really, but you convince yourself that you're right and trust the process and all the people you're collaborating with. It's just like throwing yourself in a frying pan and then praying something good comes of it. And it's always been that every time out, like, I hope I'm not crazy. Every time I start something, I hope this isn't nuts. I hope I'm not an idiot. I hope I'm not humiliating everyone who's a part of this. That's part of the fuel that gets me working hard, is I'm so worried about embarrassing everybody. I'm not so worried about my own humiliation, although I am a little bit. I'm more worried about everyone who's on screen and who worked on the project at the end feeling like, well, that was a waste of time and hurt me and my career. So that's what's strange about that time is I think after a lot of years and a lot of strange bumps, I think I had a lot of confidence after 40 Old Virgin and from my work producing for Will and Adam. I just was at a height of confidence in that moment. And I loved being around my family and Leslie, you know, my kids. And it was just pure joy to do that. And now after having done it a lot of times since then, it's still the same experience and the same terror that you're wrong. But I mean, you never will ever get back that feeling. It's like a band, you know, you don't get the feeling back of making, you know, that early album that everyone liked, even if you make another great one, even one that's just as good. But that feeling when it happened and you, you never knew what you were made of, and one of them worked and worked for everyone involved. And you're just so, so proud and happy for everybody. It was as special as those moments get.
So to use your analogies there to wrap up this conversation, Judd, because you've been so generous with your time, what abysses are you staring into at the minute? Which frying pans are you considering jumping in? Can you tell me about what the projects you've got coming up?
What's coming up? Well, I just put out a book, Sicker in the Head of More Interviews with Comedy People.
Oh, of course.
And
yeah.
I'm also working on a new book called Comedy Nerd, which is all the photos and memorabilia from all these movies and my career and some writing. I just wrote a new film that hopefully I'll get to shoot in January. We're in the middle of a strike, so everything's frozen for a little while. And I produced a movie that's going to be on Peacock that was written and stars the guys from Please Don't Destroy. Paul Briganti directed it, and it's a really, really funny, hilarious movie. And so we're in the middle of a bunch of things, and hopefully when the strike ends, they'll let us get back to the set.
Yeah, fingers crossed. But the project that you hope to shoot in January, the way that the bubble was something new for you, had like a sort of a spectacle to it and a tone to it that we hadn't. Yeah. Yeah, had all the DNA of past projects, but also felt like something new. Same deal with King of Staten Island. There was a soulfulness there that was like, again, just felt like a different added flavor. Does this new project that you've just finished, that you hope to shoot in January, does that continue to push the boat out? Or how would you describe this one?
I think so. I mean, the bubble was really fun because there was a moment where no one knew if anyone was going to even shoot movies. And so I was thinking, how can I shoot a movie safely at the height of COVID? And so I said, well, maybe the safest way to do it is to make a movie about the height of COVID. I had heard about different movies shooting, and I thought, well, maybe I can make a whole movie where half is shot in a hotel and half is shot on a green screen stage, and then that would make it safe, and I could have a small cast, and we could do our version of a Mel Brooks or Christopher Guest type movie. And it was fun to suddenly know how to create dinosaurs and have ridiculous set pieces in the movie. We had Pedro Pascal in there as an action star, and Fred Armisen and Leslie and Karen Gillan and Goose Kahn and Samson Cahill and Harry Treveldwin and Peter Serafinowicz and Maria Bakalova, all these people that I hadn't worked with before. That was a movie where, other than Leslie and Iris, I hadn't worked with everybody. And that to me was really fun. And a tone I hadn't tried in a long time, maybe since like Walk Hard or You Don't Mess with the Zohan. So this new movie is a little bit like it's hard to describe. I'm trying to make a movie that's really, really funny, that also is talking about a lot of current issues and also talking a little bit about people's disinterest in comedy. So it's a comedy about people's disinterest in comedy.
Oh, I can't wait for it, man. Well, like I say, you've been so generous with your time today, Judd. Thank you so much for chatting with us. And crucially, thank you for inventing podcasts, man.
I wish I knew. I wish I knew what it was. And then I would have gotten a cut of all of this.
Oh, well, man, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And this has been a blast. Thank you so much, Judd.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.